Greetings and salutations. It's the Agile Revolution podcast. I'm Tony.
I'm Craig.
And we have the extreme pleasure.
I see what you did there.
of podcasting with Kent Beck, the father of extreme programming. Morning, Kent.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
This is like a rock star moment for us, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to be honest. I'm a bit of a fanboying here.
Hey, the fanboy is the guy who brings his white book along for the...
There you go. And it's the first edition, too.
Yes. I have to say, the better edition, but...
Oh, God. Are we going to get into this already? All right. Fine.
Well, we have to sort of give you a little bit of background, and it is that when Craig and I first started doing Agile... We didn't even know it was Agile.
No, we didn't know what it was. Yeah,
we were just thrown into a room, I guess, with a bunch of other people, and that book was pretty much our Bible, and that's how we did it.
Got it through. We had the rest of the series, but you know, actually, I think we had the orange book, and that was actually holding up a whiteboard somewhere.
No comment.
But no, the white book was there. So, Kent, extreme programming. Tell us, like, what was the birth of that? How did that all kick off? Were you just trying to do something better? Was that the...
Well, I'd been studying alternative ways to develop software, starting with my time at Tektronix Labs in about 1984. And I compared the activities that I saw really effective software developers do to the activities as described in the books about how you do proper software engineering.
Grown up software engineering.
And exactly. which was seemed hopelessly ineffective to me. So I began a series of experiments with different parts of the process. Test-driven development came out of that. Different planning styles. Ward Cunningham took the pair programming that we had done at Tech Labs and kind of kept it alive through his next couple of employers and started teaching other people to do it. And I had lost hope that I would be able to pair program again. But, I thought it was a one-off and just magical stuff. But he kept that going and got other people to try it out and take it more seriously. And then I was asked to help lead this project at Chrysler to build an executive compensation system, which had been run in quite a chaotic fashion up until then. And the sound effects here are just fantastic. It's almost like there's somebody rolling a trash can right behind me. This is, how do you arrange this? It's wonderful. So I took the results of all those experiments of mine and the observations of mine about how really effective software developers worked, and I didn't have anything to lose, so just said, let's take all those things and crank them up to 11, and then we'll take everything else and just throw it out and see what happens. So we took a let go of a lot of conventional wisdom, and by pushing things like frequency of deployment way farther than they had been pushed, saw what the net effect of doing all those things together was. So that was how it worked, and as a process it worked well. The first, it worked at all, which was astonishing to everybody who had said how crazy this was, and then it worked really well, and there were aspects of it that traveled really well. So between all of that, that's how the XP kind of ball got rolling. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does. And do you think you surprised that? I mean, it took a little while, at least from where I was sitting, for I guess the traction to get behind it. Were you surprised that others, over the years have then flocked to it and taken to it as well as they have?
Well, I wouldn't say that they really flocked to it. The fundamental message in extreme programming is that software development is a social process, not a sum of individuals process. And I don't think we've learned that lesson yet.
Yeah, interesting.
No,
yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, and it's still the thing that we work the most with is trying to get people to talk.
Yeah.
Trust the team. Mm.
Yeah. And collaborate and empathy. You know, have empathy for somebody else's position. Those are the really hard things. Be transparent and accountable. That's a really difficult thing, for a lot of people to do. So I kind of don't think we've really gotten started.
Mm. We're probably a little, maybe it's the circles we run in, but one of the things that happened here in Australia was that Scrum didn't take off like wildfire in the early 90s as it did in the US and Europe. And so we were seeing a lot more XP in the areas that were dabbling. It was a smaller population, but because it was the people who really cared about their craft, the people who wanted to do something different that were, you know, fighting against. And so I think that's our, you know, that's our memory of those early days, that it was all XP. It's only been in more recent years when, you know, the whole certification stuff has finally, you know, rolled over the world and taken it through. We say whatever we think. Yeah,
okay. All right. I don't actually have a problem with certification. What I have a problem with is misaligned incentives. Mm-hmm. So if you certify me as a competent developer and you're on the hook for that, if I turn out not to be a competent developer and it comes out of your pocket, that means something, because our incentives are aligned. There are other forms of certification where the incentives aren't aligned. And that's what I really have a problem with.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody cares about certificates. What we care about is competence. And certificates are some proxy for competence, but the more the incentives are misaligned, the less of a proxy the certificates are. Hmm. So like in America, a board certified doctor, that means something. The most experienced doctors in a field form the board. If you screw up once in your board exams, you're out. And you have to wait a year of intense studying before you can go to be board certified again. A board certified surgeon means you know your craft for sure. And there are people whose names are on that, and it really matters. I would love to have that in software engineering, but it's insanely expensive.
It's an interesting thing. We see that all the time. There was I think it was yesterday we were talking with Yuri yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And she made a comment. I said to Craig, I absorbed it. Went home on the train because I have a long train trip. Mm-hmm. Came back and we were talking about the rise of Scrum versus XP. And she said, you know, the reality of it is all of the practices in XP really were there, and Scrum has just marketed it better. And I sort of started thinking back to our journey and thinking, you know, we were doing all of those things, but I'd forgotten it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, so for me, I think is the XP is as poignant today as it ever was. Those practices are there. People are still doing them. They just don't realize it's XP.
Yes, I certainly get a lot of that. No, I've never heard your name. And then I start listing JUnit, TDD. Oh, sure, of course. I know all that stuff, which is fine. Like, if I had to choose between my name being known and my work being known, I'd rather have my work be known, because that's how I keep track of impact. Yeah. I think what I'm seeing as I go around the world and talk to lots of people, I get these nostalgia stories about XP. I was in South Africa. I had a guy come up and thank me for the three best years of his software engineering career, 2002 to 2004. And I burst into tears. He obviously had no hope that he would ever be on a functional team again. But that one XP team he was on was the highlight of his whole career.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
he was just never going to see it again. And I'm just,
2006, 2008.
I think we talk about it a lot. Yeah. And it was just that moment for us where everything came together.
Yeah.
And the people that we worked with, the people, we're all still in touch. Mm-hmm. Still friends.
Yeah, lots of them here, and lots of them, and all doing good things in other places, and affecting that too.
Well, here's the thing. There is this cadre of people who've been doing XP, maybe by name, maybe under the table, for the last 15, 20 years. They know it works. They're better at it than I am, and they would love to see it spread. So I think that it's time for a renaissance, for the reboot, to bring back XP, to learn from the mistakes that we made the first time. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of kind of geeky chest thumping, which we need to get away from. Mm-hmm. There was not an effort to make sure we include all the engineering talent in the world, which we absolutely have to deal with. To stop making things hard for people with a different gender, different background, different amounts of melanin in their skin. Like, who cares? You can't refactor because you're brown. It just doesn't make any sense. So this time around, I think we need to pay attention to those factors, especially us pale male guys, that we made it easy for us, and we need to make sure that there are no barriers for other people who want to join into this. I think if we do that, there's a real opportunity. On the business side, the agile transformations that tried to do things the easy way have petered out, and I'm getting CEOs come to me and say, you know, I spent all this time and all this money on an agile transformation. I'm just not seeing any difference. And we, people of the book, know. We know how to make a difference. And it starts with execution and continues to empathy, where if you can really execute as a team, then you can afford to listen really deeply to what other people are saying about the effects of your software on their lives, what they'd like to see next. You can be more creative in meeting their real needs instead of just the expressed needs on the surface. I think there is a possibility of a reboot for XP, and I would love to see that happen.
And so is that something that that you're now looking at seriously?
Enough so that I have a name for it.
Wow.
And we'll see. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's early days. I think it needs to focus on more on education. I think there needs to be a business model. One of the things that Scrum did great that we did terribly in XP is people need to, if you want people to donate their time, their energy, their financial capital, they need to see that there's a business model that serves them in that process. Scrum did that. Yeah, lots of people could see how they could make a living off of Scrum. The XP market was never more than a few million dollars a year worldwide. And there's just, that can't, we have to have some solution to that.
At least the sustainability, I think. I think that's why a lot of things come and go. There's great ideas, but you know, do you want to jump on that bandwagon if it's not going to be sustainable?
Yeah, if it's not going to feed your family. So we need to be more business-like while being aware of the incentive alignment problem that other people seem to have ignored.
It's an interesting thing because the organization that we came from made a very, we chose very carefully the languages and the things that we were constructing around our agility, around the XP modem. So we stuck with iteration management, iterations, and applying the XP practices at the base of what we did. And a lot of people didn't realize why we did that, because we were definitely trying to set ourselves apart from the Scrum method.
But it was always big tent agility as well. Like it's not any one method. You know, Alistair Coburn's, let's learn from the best things out there and take little bits. So there are some good bits in.
Well, yes and no.
There are some good bits in DSDM and you know, if you're trying to solve a problem, bits in Scrum.
No question about it. The downside that I have seen over and over again is that big tent becomes an excuse not to confront hard problems.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes.
And lo and behold, that just doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
So I'm, as I said, I think we need to take inclusion much more seriously than even other people in the software development world are taking it. We need to push. What is the XP version of inclusion? What's that dials to 11 for inclusion? So, for example, I spend time in Central Africa teaching programming with a company called Andela because there's amazing tech talent there. Okay, so they mostly work remotely. So if that's a prerequisite to being able to include a wider set of people, then we need to look at the trade-offs between co-located remote teams. Mm. And there isn't one answer, but there is a set of trade-offs there, and there's a variety of possible answers, and as a community, we need to get behind that whole space of possibilities instead of the, you know, here's the one answer for this and the one answer for that and the one answer for that.
Mm, I agree. One of the things, I guess, out of the whole XP thing in the book was there's a diagram in the book somewhere which has all the arrows that point to all the methods. And that to me has always been, my always go-to, because in order to do any of these things effectively, all these things rely on everything else. And so one of the things we find in the Agile community is people seem to cherry-pick, and they'll go, I might have collective code ownership, but no, I don't want to do that pair programming thing. And
right.
and I'll do automated testing, but not unit testing, because that's overrated.
Oh.
And so that diagram has always been one where you can actually see the interrelations between all the parts of XP. And that.
Well, there's lots of places to start, but indeed, not thinking about all the legs on the stool leaves you sitting on the ground. And some of those legs are going to require changes in belief, like this fundamental belief that software development's a social process. If you don't confront that, you're just going to have a hard time with everything else.
You good?
So test-driven development. So again,
that was the question I was going to ask.
So that book also was one of the things I loved about that book was it was so accessible. You know, I started on page one and said just do the small things, small steps. You know, and then for another 300 pages, reminder of the small steps. But to this day,
thank you for that dismissive summary.
But today, that's always the thing in the back of my mind is whenever I get stuck, it's like you know what would Kent say? Small steps, and away you. Where you go back.
However, when you're working with teams, so I was saying to someone the other day, what I found over the X amount of years I've been doing this now, I did have hair once, when I go into the teams, it's the simple stuff they've got away from, the simple basics. And test-driven development is the one that I have the most arguments over.
Mm-hmm.
Because test my code first? What?
Well, unit test my code?
What? Unit test my
code. At all, sure.
At all, right. Sure. And you can't
pick it. It was never optional.
All right, how can that be an option, right?
Well, so I think this is another one that I think comes down to a transformation of beliefs. As a programmer, am I responsible for my code running?
Absolutely.
And the, well...
Well, if you're not, who
that's
is?
That's the obvious, that's the simple answer. But people don't behave that way. Like, I wasn't raised that way. I was raised with programmers can't be trusted to test their own code.
Yeah.
So you had to rely on external QA or else. Once you have that transformation of belief, when you say, no, I'm responsible for this code running in production, and I'm going to do everything that I need to do so I can sleep well at night, then... unit testing falls out of that. TDD is a set of feedback loops and an incentive system to encourage even more confidence and certainty. And the new work that I've been doing with the test commit revert takes that even another step further. So this is the idea that you run the tests, if they pass, you commit your changes, and if they fail, you revert the changes. So if you write 10 lines of code and it doesn't pass the first time, those 10 lines just disappear. That creates incentives to figuring out how to write one of the lines first in a way that passes, and then the other 9 afterwards. And more effort goes into taking even smaller steps, but you don't have big debugging situations as you do if you're taking larger steps. So in TDD, a common dysfunction is you'll see a red, green, red, green, red, green. All is going well, right? Then green, green, green. Okay, I'm refactoring. Red, red, red. Like, at that point, you really should just go back to the last green state.
Yep.
But you know, sunk cost fallacy leads us to believe that we really, oh, you know, I'm about to find the last bug. No, you're about to find the next bug.
Mm. And then if it does go green, did you fix the first red or the second red or the third red?
Right, yeah. Right, and you have no idea. So I think that we can push that even further. If we do, if you take this test commit revert style and you put that together with push on green, that means you're pushing, each person is causing a push to production multiple times a minute. Mm. Like, that's crazy. But if you do that, then you're able to collaborate with other people in a much finer grain way. The hypothesis is that you'll find disagreement much sooner that way. Mm. And that you'll disrupt production much less because all the incentive systems line up for you to be making small, safe changes.
It's interesting. That was always my allure. I mean, it was filling out a unit testing spreadsheet and doing it manually. So thank you. So on behalf of me from the rest of the world, thank you for the X unit tools that stopped me filling out a spreadsheet to do unit testing and could do code, which I actually enjoyed doing. But yeah, it was that fast feedback loop. The fact that I wanted to get in faster than the next person, so that right. You know, so that their merge conflicts were there, and then that forced conversation. And that to me was always even the bigger thing about. Plus the fact I actually had a bunch of tests that were there to back up my code.
I was working with a team a few months ago that were doing very similar stuff, and they were doing well. And I was asked to come and look at them, and they were arguing. Man, they were going at a hammer and tongs. And their leader said to me, "This is what I'm talking about." And I said, "What's wrong with that?" And he's going, "They're arguing, they're fighting, it's like children." And I said, "Yeah, that's what they want to do. As long as it's actually not the kind of language and argument that's causing, intellectual or damage to them.
To the relationships.
Relationships. Yeah. If you listen to them, it was actually that argument around, well, I did this and you should do it that way and this is a better way to do it. So he left them alone. And they're producing great code.
Mm-hmm. But productive conflict is a whole lot better than silence. Yeah.
Headphones on.
Silence is the sound of risk.
I love that.
Yeah, I like that. I'm going to steal that.
That means you're not getting feedback.
Yeah.
And that, which is fine if you don't make any mistakes. You don't need feedback. You just have to be perfect. If you're not perfect, then you need feedback.
That's great. So you want to progress XP. You want to reboot XP.
Yep.
Yeah. How can people help you to do that?
A great question. No simple answer yet. I think... a little we all need to own it. I think the XP community has some PTSD from losing, because we had a better product and we lost, and there's a certain amount of sulk going on.
Good. No, we just say we agree with your Scrum thing, but we're going to call it an iteration. and it's a planning game, but whatever you want to call it.
So I think we need to get over that, just kind of the emotional baggage of having lost. Mm. But we lost round one. Mm. So the next thing is starting to own what we're doing in public. Just call it XP. Mm. Be proud. Wear the shirt. Wear the hat, own what we're doing. And then there's, I think the most important thing I can do, and you all can contribute, is there's 20 years worth of pretty much independent evolution. There are the little pockets where there'll be, I've just met you guys in China. I met a group of people who'd been doing XP since 2002. Mm. I mean, they really know some stuff, but the evolution happened on all these separate islands in different directions, whether it's coaching, testing, deployment, and so on and so forth. So we need to find ways of pulling that back together as a community with our diversity, but learning the lessons from the past 15 years that we've all learned from each other so that we do have a cohesive story once again. And we kind of, we lost that cohesive story, that single thread. We need to get that back together so that we can go to the people with the money and the people with the formal authority and say, you have an alternative. It's hard work. Here's the work. Here's the payoff.
Yeah. Well said.
I was sitting in the train trying to think of questions I wanted to ask you. I had a million of them.
Electric. Tony, just for reference, Tony and I are both skull enhanced. So, are you an electric or a blade?
Yeah, I'm a blade.
Okay. I love how it feels, but it's just a little too much hassle for me.
Yeah, you gotta be careful of that nick.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
It can ruin your morning.
Now, I'm sure your listeners, almost all of them, are going to be really interested in this part of the conversation. Go ahead with your question.
He obviously hasn't listened before.
So, one of the questions, it's more a statement and then your thought on it, right? So the validity of XP, right? So a lot of people sort of say, what's the validity of XP today? And I think, you know, people like us realize that. But for me, it's the propensity of the damage bad code today is bigger than it ever was. So sloppy coding, we've got cars with more code in them than what was used to send a man to the moon.
Oh, and you do not want to look at that code.
And this
guaranteed.
This is incredibly my point. Even, you know, the smallest devices we carry in our pockets or in our home, and we're trusting that code.
Yeah.
And XP is a mechanism to start to make a better world for that type of thing, in my assessment.
Well, both the technical and social aspects of XP contribute to that. I think that's something I'm going to come back to over and over again, because I got derailed onto the, sure, here's this technical practice and that technical practice and that technical practice. This idea, this divide and conquer idea that's sort of seeped into everybody's brain, you know, and I blame Frederick Taylor for this whole rant about Frederick Taylor. That's what I think we have to come back to over and over again and say, no, that is not the most effective way to develop software.
I wonder if that was... Because one of the things I often refer to is that, to me, XP kind of died away because the core technical practices just became good software engineering practice. Whether people are doing them or not is a different argument.
Yeah.
But they became good software engineering practice. But I think everyone forgot about, as you say, the social and the other aspects that were built into XP in the first place. But I wonder, I just think back to my early days of trying this. We read the book and we went, test-driven development, but then it all became like, well, now we need to learn test-driven development. And so that took us 6 months to get really good at that craft. And so it was that mission, that mental learning of doing that and you know, not taking for granted things like collective code ownership. I mean, that's one that, you know, to me has died away a little bit. I think we're a lot, there's still pockets of it, but I think we're a lot better at it. But I think that 20 years we've been getting really good at these practices, and now it's at the time's right to bring it back together again. And that's why I come back to that diagram of arrows that says, actually, all these things have to interplay to be successful, including the how we actually work together.
We both know how to do it better, and we know how to teach it better. Enough better so that we have a chance of winning this time when we lost last time? I don't know. I mean, that's the way you play the game, to find out. But the impact that XP could have on software and the impact that software could have on the world in a positive way, we're not even close to that. If that's true, then it's worth taking another run at this.
Yeah, and even if we just get a few more converts, you know, and then we get some better software out of it, then it has to be a good thing, right?
It sure would be nice. Yes.
And I mean, that collaborativeness that you're talking about, you know, there's no excuse today for us not to be... So, you know, the distributed thing was always the problem. You know, oh, you can't do XP because you're distributed, or, you know, you have to work over here by yourself. With the technology we have available now, collaborating with someone on the other side of the world is something that should just happen.
Well, it's always easier if you're sitting face to face, but that's a trade-off. So if it's not possible to sit together face to face, okay. So what else are we going to, give up? That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense because it excludes so many people who could be amazing software developers. And I think if we, if XP starts with the premise that we want, you talk about a big tent. This is a big tent I can sign up for. We want a process that everyone with talent and skill can contribute to and grow at maximum velocity. If we do that, the rest of this is going to take care of itself.
Absolutely. You'd be remiss if it's not on an Agile podcast to just talk briefly about the manifesto for Agile software development.
Yeah.
To use its name. You know, now what we're 18 something years now past that. What are your thoughts? I mean, did you ever expect that, you know, sitting in Snowbird for a couple of days that you know that the explosion around this would have happened the way it did?
Sure. Yeah. Because we were right.
Well, of course, yeah. I agree. I saw. We're still fighting the fight, though.
And even the, again, with the misaligned incentives, where, I mean, the problem with Agile as the name for it is it's so attractive that nobody doesn't want to be Agile. Oh, no, I'd rather be rigid.
Yeah.
And I'd rather be, fragile, and I'd rather just guess at stuff. Nobody's going to say that.
Well, no, it's just like saying you don't like puppies, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the thing, I took a lot of heat about the name extreme programming, but the one thing about it is if you're not extreme in this sense that we use it, you're not going to say that you are, because you're going to take some guff about it. But that means that the brand actually has meaning over time. Mm. Now you see agility applied to everything and it means nothing. So that's like, I figured that it would take off. Mm. But I also figured that it was going to get watered down in a big hot hurry. Mm. And I think that that's happened.
Yeah, I think one of my big bugbears is this, that every man and his dog has got on the Agile thing.
Sure.
And I think it's Ron Jeffries who, you know, coined the phrase dark agile or faux agile. When we used to walk into organizations, it used to be why you should do agile, right? Now it's, well, we're doing agile and it's not working.
Right.
Come and help us fix it. And when we go in there, it's agile in a wolf's clothing type thing, right?
Sure. I had somebody tell me they couldn't do agile because they just wanted to write some code. They couldn't deal with all that process and that ceremony. And that was, again, just a gut punch for me, because that's exactly what we were trying to get away from, process and ceremony. And as the WHO so eloquently put it, meet the new boss, we're back in the same position. But that's because the incentives haven't changed, the beliefs haven't changed, so we get the same results. It shouldn't be a surprise. Mm. But there it is. So if we're going to reboot XP, it has to be, for it to have impact, it has to be from a position of becoming aware of the incentives, changing them so that they're more aligned than they have been in the past, and confronting the beliefs that we have, like programming as a solo activity, that just have outlived their usefulness. If we don't get to the fundaments, the whether people pair program or not just isn't going to make any difference.
And I think that's, you know, that's why we are still proponents of all the things that are written in the manifesto, values and principles, because, you know, with the exception, I think, of one of the principles that's a little out of date, which is, you know, how fast you develop software. That's probably aged a little bit. You know, the rest of it still really holds true. And those fundamentals, when we do go into those failed organizations, that's actually what they're not following.
Right.
Yeah.
And, number 10 particularly.
What's your antenna?
Simplicity, the art of maximizing the amount of work not done.
Yes.
Is essential.
Mm-hmm.
So they put all of these layers and all of this stuff over the top that they just don't need. And it was never the intention, I believe.
No, absolutely not. So a fundamental shift in my thinking over the past, like starting about 2 years ago, is there's there's a very important question to ask first before you think about how to develop software, which is, how much do we have to lose? So I'll talk about that in my keynote today. If you're a two-person startup and you got 4 months of money in the bank, you don't have a lot to lose. So you should be trying really short, really crazy experiments to find something that nobody else is doing. Sustainability of your code doesn't matter. So if you can run an experiment without writing tests quicker than you could do the same experiment with writing tests, then you shouldn't write tests. You shouldn't refactor. If there's something that helps you run experiments quicker, like some bit of automation, that's worth investing in. But you have to be very cognizant of that short-term, long-term trade-off. Okay, so that's the explore part of the project. Rules of the game are very different. Compare that to now we have a 1,000-person company and $1 billion coming in, and you really don't want to mess that up. So even as fundamental an aspect of XP as courage, the value of courage, when you're exploring, courage is awesome, because that leads you to potential sources of value that other people have overlooked because they just chicken out. When you're extracting value from a known successful business proposition and you have 3-4x of growth left, courage is the last thing I want somebody to demonstrate. Well, let's just blow up this business model and start. No. So when you're at that far part of that extract part of the curve, you're going to live with this code for a long time. Testing, absolutely. Refactoring, absolutely. Automation, absolutely. All that stuff makes sense because all the trade-offs have shifted. There is an art to cheap, quick hacks, just as there's an art to maintainable, sustainable, long-term livable code. And it depends on where you are on the curve, which of those basket of tricks you should pull out. So there's things about XP that are good for exploration, but there's other stuff that if you just blindly follow them is going to lead you to fewer experiments in those 4 months and a lower chance of success. At the same time, there's stuff that you need to do in extraction that isn't talked about in the XP books about careful analysis, usage analysis, for example, where you want to find out how features are really being used before you modify them. You don't just go try stuff out, let's see what happens, because you really don't want to lose out on a sustainable, profitable software business. They don't come along that often. So that's a big shift in my thinking. I talk about this 3X model, explore, expand, extract, where the rules of the game really change depending on whether you're looking for a new source of value. Holy cow, we found one and it's growing faster than we can keep up. And that's the expand phase, and this extract phase where you continue growing and you're pulling value out of it to pay for the next round of exploration.
You were just saying before courage, and my thought process was that you said there's no courage in the expand phase, but the courage has to be to say, we're going to keep this thing running, and have the courage now to pull some people back to go and find the next big idea, though. Because when you look at the world, it's lit with the people who are resting on their laurels of the last big thing they did.
Right. I think one of the blights I talk to software teams about is safe to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And they use that as an excuse just to throw stuff out into production. It's okay, it's safe to fail. And it's goes, okay, let's change that terminology to fail safely.
Mm-hmm.
So it's having a containment strategy where you can test that, you can explore, you can do things, having the courage to do that before you do affect it, which is what I see from what you're talking about.
Right. Yeah, that's, you've gone through the curve once, and now, like, it's just a cash cow, and we want to cash out on this until the money dries up, and then we all have our yachts, and away we go. Or is there more to this? Can we use those resources to fund the next round of explorations and see if what seems like a whole curve to us is really just the beginning of a much larger curve? In which case, yeah, you need to have that, you need to be able to fail safely, because they're experiments. You don't know how they're going to turn out. If you know how it's going to turn out, it's not an experiment. So, but it has to fail in a way that doesn't affect the ongoing operations.
There's nothing that strikes fear into the God of an executive more to say, oh, they're all right, that team over there is going to, you know, they're safe to fail. It's going to safe to fail my business, right?
So. Right.
One last thing I want to, we can talk to you for hours, and you're an avid poker player.
I sure am.
I understand. Do you draw the parallels between between this and poker? Are there things now that you've learnt in becoming a good poker player that we now can apply back into software and vice versa?
Sure. I'd say the first one is the idea of expected value. That in poker, you can play badly and win, and you need to not feel good about that. And you can play well and lose, and you need to not feel bad about that. In software development, you can try a bunch of ideas, and you can be very effective at trying them out. As long as you stop investing in an idea as soon as you can know that it's not worth investing in, you've done exactly the right thing. And then another concept is a concept of variance, which is just because I flipped heads four times in a row doesn't mean anything. Like, sometimes you flip heads four times in a row. And there's a huge difference between great poker players and good poker players, in that great poker players just don't get rattled by bad luck. You know, if I have the second best hand and you have the best hand, and that happens four times in a row, and if we swap the cards, I would get all the money instead of you getting all the money, that's just poker. If you get rattled by that, then you start playing badly. And when you play badly, you can lose a lot of money in a big, hot hurry. So I just take that in stride at the poker table, and I take it in stride in my exploration of new technical ideas. The last four of them didn't work out. That's fine. Next, away we go. Without getting rattled, without giving up, without losing my energy.
Wow.
Well, I guess we've sort of reached the end of our time, and the crowds are starting to come, so the noise will be a bit overbearing. It's been fantastic for us to actually talk to you.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be back in Australia after 22 or 3 years.
I know the Yow crowd, everyone has been so excited to see you out here, because as I said, you say that you know, we lost, but there is that portion of the community, and particularly people that we swing in.
We lost a round.
We're still playing.
Absolutely.
We're still fighting it. And I would say to our two listeners, no, the listeners that we have, I'm calling on the XP Army, because that's what we are. We're the XP Army. We might have lost that first round, but you heard some things today from Kent. Let's do it. Let's take those things and let's make this happen, and work with Kent to make XP where it should be.
And we're gonna win with community and inclusion.
Yeah. Yeah, I really love that. So if people want to know more, if they want to follow follow your thoughts, and as you start to develop this out now, where's the best place to follow you?
KentBeck.com.
KentBeck.com. Excellent.
Nice and simple.
It's been an absolute privilege. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and thank you for all of your work. It's changed my world
and mine. We wouldn't be where we are doing what we're doing if it wasn't for yourself.
Well, you guys also did a lot of hard work. I'm glad you found it helpful.
We need the place to start. We thank you for that, because lots of sleepless nights. It was you look back through the book and get some inspiration. It was
And we'd come in and go, in the book, that paragraph there.
That's it. Read that diagram. Read that again. Thank you very much, Kent.
My pleasure.
Now, one last thing.
So on the count of three. Viva la revolution.
All right, on the count of three. One, two, three.
Viva la revolution.
Thank you very much.